What's the date today?
Today is the 23rd.
Today is March 23rd. Okay, 2010. I'm Sherry Bowers, the local history coordinator at the Milan Berlin Township Public Library. And I'm sitting here with Chief James Ward of the Milan Police Department. And we're going to talk about a reflection of 20 years when Larry Lambert took the first photograph of Chief Ward and get kind of a 20-year perspective about the police department and Chief Ward's role as chief of police. So maybe I'll have you start, Chief, with telling us a little bit about when you first started on the police department.
Okay. I started in 1976. I actually was a school teacher at the Ehovia Joint Vocational School, and I came on the department part-time in 76 and worked part-time from 76 through 79. And then Chuck Lindekamp became the chief, and he approached me about taking a full-time job, which was his job as a sergeant, when he became chief. And so in 79, I resigned from teaching and became a sergeant full-time on the police department, and was a sergeant for 2 years. And when Chuck resigned, then I applied for and became chief in 1981. And here I am, 2010, and still the chief.
That original picture that was taken was actually in the old police department.
Yes. Our one-room Andy Griffith Police Department, as I call it. Yeah, that was a kind of a quaint little unique situation. We were in the back room of the combination of utility office police department, which presented itself with some unique situations where you as a parent would come in with your child to pay the utility bill, and I'd have somebody in the back under arrest for various reasons or whatever, and sometimes there was less than proper language used or colorful language was exhibited, and so it was kind of a nice balance of trying to maintain a utility office and run a police department in a one-room station. Probably the most unique thing was the restroom was in a closet, and if you were claustrophobic, you certainly didn't want to go there. In fact, we have the old picture of it up there, the old station, so it was neat, and it was quaint, but it just really... You know, with it wasn't handicap accessible, and that was one of the big things as well. We had no room for storage, and then we moved over here into the new facility, and it was like moving into a Taj Mahal castle, so to speak. We went from one room to nine rooms with a two-car garage, which was a interesting thing, and we used a cell. The old cell was the storage in there. There actually was three cells back there in the day. So the area where our office was is where two cells had been removed. We actually still have the old desk and cabinets from that office are in the what we call the radio room here at the new place. And it's really unique to show people about the amount of room that we came from to where we're at now, which is a pretty modern station with workstations for the two full-time officers. And I have my own office. I have to tell you, it's so nice to be able to work on something and leave the stuff out on my desk, and it's there in the morning when I come back, rather than have to put everything away. So that's one of the biggest things is the change of to the new building. And I really, the two-car garage that we have, we're able to keep the cars inside, which I believe has helped extend the life of the cars rather than sitting out. And I can remember days when the locks were froze up. I had to go out with hot water, pour hot water on it so I could get in the police car to go to a call, because we didn't have garage facilities to keep them. But with, we now have computers in those cars, we have video systems in those cars. It's just not good for them sitting out in the weather like that. So
really, I guess with especially, when you mentioned computers and the things that are in cars now with technology, you probably couldn't even function as a department because of all the technology that you have to have now. Isn't it really because of the way you have to link with other departments, do you think?
The biggest thing is the computers and the cars. I mean, what's really funny is when, and every now and then the computers do go down, as anything electronic, we all know. It's interesting to hear the officers complain because they don't have the computer to be able to run the plates to find out who this is, if someone's wanted. Before, you had to kind of pick and choose because we had to get on the actual radio and contact the sheriff's department, or the city of Norwalk was always good with us. But you had to kind of bide your time because you didn't want to interrupt them if they had something going on. Now with the computers, we're able to run license plates and know immediately if someone's wanted, whether that plate's on the right car. And probably one of the biggest things now is, I think back over the years, of probably how many people had given me fake names. And I really didn't know the difference because they knew their brother's social security number or their sister's. Well, now we have the capability right there in the car of bringing up on the computer a picture. And I can probably think of at least two dozen instances where someone has given us a social security number and the pictures come up on the screen and it's not them. And the person has commented, oh, I didn't know you could do that. And so then they tell us, oh, my name's really Tom Jones. And so it's kind of interesting.
So if you stop me and you run my plates or my license, you look at my license, you'll see that match if my driver's license yes. picture will come up and
I have
match
the ability,
my license.
I have the ability of making that picture come up if I want to. Okay. And, you know, for example, and I have to say being in police work 34 years, 99% of the time most women have their purse with them mm-hmm. and they have their driver's license with them. The 1% or 2% that don't usually don't have a driver's license. And that's kind of an instant tip off to me when I stop a female who doesn't have a driver's license, which, for example, this morning was I stopped a lady, didn't have her driver's license with her. She's suspended. So now we have ability of instantaneously knowing what the car should be, what color. Now that in the last few years, now that you list your color of your car on your license plate when you register it. So I know that license plate ABC should be on a blue Chevy. Well, now it's on a red Dodge, so I know something's wrong. Yeah, it's not been changed over or something. So there's a lot more information instantaneously available to us, and it will alert us immediately. For example, if I stop a car, that if someone has a warrant, it will verbally tell us there's a warrant. If someone's on parole, it will tell us they're on parole. So there's a lot more officer safety things available than there used to be in the old days.
Speaking of safety, there's a story that you shared with Larry Lambert and I about it had to do with coming. They came off the turnpike, but I want you to tell me if you could about that. But before that, when you talk about officer safety, so really, if you stop someone and let's say there is a warrant, but you know that maybe this is really a dangerous person mm-hmm. wanted by the FBI, that does that alert other police departments locally too? For instance, let's say you stop someone out on 250 and this person was wanted by the FBI, known to be very dangerous, armed and dangerous.
Yeah. We are currently connected through the Erie County Sheriff's Department through our MDTs, the mobile data terminals, which are the computers. If I stop someone who is wanted, it puts out an alert which goes to all of the other cruisers on that system. So that would be all of Erie County Sheriff, City of Huron, City of Perkins, City of Sandusky, Village of Berlin Heights, Village of Castalia, it all pops up on their screen that I have stopped a guy that's wanted. So there's a safety net there that people know that, whoa, wait a minute, Milan has this car stopped or Berlin Heights has a car stopped that's potentially a dangerous thing. So, and every now and then if you do that, the Sheriff's Department will contact you either by radio or on the computer. We can actually type to each other and they'll ask if you need any help or if everything's okay. So, or they'll, you know, ask you where you're at. And the purpose of that is so that they can send a car. Now, the Sheriff's Department actually has GPSs in their car. They know at all times where their cars are. It shows right on the screen. So things have definitely changed in the 34 years of being a police officer from, you know, running around out here blind to, you know, now we're on the system where people can visually see that you have someone stopped. We have instantaneous information available to us to know who I'm supposed to be stopping. And if that person is a wanted or a violent person, that will come up on there. I mean, sure, there's people that fall under the radar that you don't know they're violent until it happens. But, you know, at least it gives a little more to the officer safety. And now, too, we have videos in the cars, which videotape everything that we do and what we say, both in and outside the car. So that's a positive as well. And you know, now officers carry tasers. You know, rather than the old days, you carried a mace where you sprayed somebody. Now the tasers, electronic darts, go out and temporarily immobilize somebody with that. Our officers carry those. So it's kind of a safety thing for them. Plus, it's a element of force that we don't have to use serious physical force against somebody. Mm-hmm. You wanted the story?
Yes, very interesting story.
I remember this like it was yesterday. The guys were escaped from a Tennessee jail. I ended up having to work a Sunday night shift because someone was sick. There was no one else to work, and I was working. And the car was coming down, coming up 250. They had gotten off the turnpike, which I found out later. And they'd gone down to Mickey Mart down in Norwalk to get gas. And their original intention was going to be to rob the gas station while they were there because they were going to get jumped back on the turnpike. Well, they said they didn't because either a state patrol car or a police car pulled in or came by or something. So they got nervous. So they got their gas and they were going back to the turnpike, and they actually had a switch in the car that could turn off their taillights in the back, so you couldn't see them going down the road. Well, the guy had evidently flipped off the switch, thinking they were going to do the robbery, and forgot to flip it back on. So when they came north, going back to the turnpike, I saw a car with no rear taillights. So I pulled it over, like just about 10 feet just past the traffic light down here at 250 and 113, which there wasn't a light then. It was the corner. And it was a Tennessee plate, I remember, and I don't know why, but I just immediately kind of had this inkling that this was not good. And I just kind of went into a different mode that this wasn't a regular traffic stop. I remember getting out of my car and walking around the back of my car so that they didn't see me cross the headlights of my car. And I noticed the driver was looking left and looking right like he was trying to see where the police officer was coming. As I got closer to the car, I pretended there was a second officer, and I think I said, "No, hey, Bob, I'll stop this. You just stand by there." And I said, they both started looking left and right, and I walked up to the side, and I remember the driver had his hand, his right hand, inside of his coat. Mm-hmm. And I shined the flashlight and told him, "Take your hand out of your coat." And I had to tell him like three times. He finally took his hands out of his coat and put them up. I said, "Grab the dash from the steering wheel." And just as I was doing that, a state patrol car came by, and there was two officers from the turnpike that were going home, and they motioned to me, and I motioned for them to stop, and they came over. Come to find out, like I say, the two fellows were escaped from a Tennessee jail. They actually beat up a guard pretty bad. Consequently, the guy in driving had a gun in a shoulder holster, and he had his hand on the gun, and he told me that if I'd have walked up there like most cops, he was just going to shoot me right through the jacket and shoot me. And his name was Mark Allen something. I can't remember his name right now. And that was back in 1980 something, 81, I think it was. There was a fellow actually sleeping in the back seat, which I didn't even know. He was under a bunch of coats. He was a hitchhiker that had gotten picked up. He was in the back seat. Consequently, all in the trunk of the car, I found another gun, a box of marijuana, and a bunch of rolls of change from a place in Portland, Indiana. And in backtracking, they had actually committed a robbery in Portland, Indiana, where they sexually assaulted a couple of the girls that worked there. And that was the money that they took from that robbery. So they were ultimately charged in Indiana for armed robbery. And I'm not sure where they ended up. I know the state of Tennessee came and got them from the Erie County Jail. And I don't know if Indiana charged them or what. But I ended up getting a national award for catching that from the international or police chiefs of thing or something.
It's interesting that you said that you had that feeling even when you knew that something was wrong when you pulled them over. And maybe that's – I wonder how often that helps police officers in their line of duty, you know, because...
Well, I think all too often, you know, new police officers, it's the same thing over and over. And, you know, one of the things I've tried to instill in policemen, look, what you think is the fifth traffic stop of the day for you is a life-threatening, heart-throbbing experience for a person who maybe's never been stopped by the police. So you have to kind of keep that in mind that you can't treat everyone, you know, just like this is a number. And I guess I just learned to listen to my body vibe, so to speak, and that there's times where you just get a bad feeling about what's going to go on, and you got to go with your gut instincts. And I did. And had I walked up on that car like I would have done maybe 90 out of 100 times, the guy admitted to me that he was just going to shoot me right through his jacket and because they didn't want to get caught. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and thank goodness the two state patrolmen were going by because I don't know. You know, there was one of me and three of them. And, you know, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, it had a lot of variables that who knows which way it would have swung. You know, as it worked out, only the driver had a gun. The other one was in the trunk. But like I say, it's I guess as an officer, you learn to listen to your instincts and what you're doing. And like I say, different situations, you know, you do different things. And, you know, you just get, I tell my guys, you got to learn to be systematically unsystematic. And you have to do that. You just can't be a robot and do the same thing every time. And like I say, it was apparent to me that their interest in me was as much as I had in them by them looking around to see where I was coming and approaching on the car. And I remember the one guy saying to me that he said, "Where's the other policeman?" Because when I said, "Hey, Bill, I'll get this over here," and it was like the voice just kind of threw him, and they thought there actually was two of us when there was one. And like I say, it could have had a whole lot different outcome, you know, probably not for the good side if I'd have went up there. I mean, who knows what would happen? But as it worked out, I mean, everybody, they went to jail and I went home, so.
I imagine in small towns, you know, people probably think, oh, well, that, you know, there isn't much that really happens. And I know you've shared some other stories with us, too. Somebody coming from Florida, I think, at one time with a load of marijuana in the bag.
He was a Miami police officer.
Okay.
And here again, I was working a midnight shift, and I don't remember why, but I was. And here again, I stopped him. I can't remember the reason for the stop as such, but when I stopped him, the spare tire was in the back seat, and his luggage was in the back seat, and the car was, like, weighted down in the back end. And you know, there's a drug profile that came out of Florida of certain indicators to look for. And this guy had, like, 8 of the 10 indicators just right there, very obvious of what I saw. Didn't know whose name the car was rented in, which was kind of strange. I mean, you know, if you rent a car, you know you rented a car.
Mm-hmm.
Had no idea what was in the trunk. Well, I don't know about you, but when I drive a car, I know what's in my car.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, found marijuana on him. He identified himself, had the ID of a Miami police officer. At one point, he talked to me about offered me money to let him go, that he makes more money in a day than I make in a year. Ultimately, we got a search warrant for the car and found 500 pounds of marijuana and 2 bales in the trunk of the car. My understanding is that Miami police officer then turned over and went in the witness protection program or something, but cooperated with the customs or FBI or whatever, and then ended up cracking a big drug ring through the arrest that a small town, little town policeman
mm-hmm.
made an arrest on. So, you know, and I think that is the thing. Everybody thinks that, you know, the police in small towns, all you do is drive around, you don't do anything. And you know, it's one of those deals where, as I told new officers coming in, the police works 90% boredom and 10% excitement, or maybe 8% excitement and 2% of just pure frightening. And, you know, a perfectly nothing day can go from nothing to everything in 1 minute where, you know, you could end up having to take someone's life. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's the hardest thing in a small town to, you know, keep people on edge to the point where you don't want to treat everyone like they're criminals. And I think sometimes that younger officers forget that, is that it's a life experience for someone to get stopped by the police. And someone is, well, you know, you're treating me like a criminal. I've heard that many, many times. And, you know, I've tried to tell people, look, this is an unfair situation. You know everything about me. You know I have a gun. You know that I'm probably trained. I know nothing about you. I don't know whether you're a teacher, you know, a Sunday school teacher, a dairy salesman, you know, a flight instructor, or you're a wanted murderer. I don't know that. And so consequently, you know, I have to go through the checks and stuff that I've been trained and learned to do to make myself have a little bit of comfort level that I'm not dealing with someone who has a gun under their coat. And, you know, in this day and age, too, I mean, there are thousands of people out there now that have carried concealed weapons permits. Mm-hmm. So it changes things a lot that someone may have a gun on them. And it's like, you know, that split second is, whoa, is this guy a law-abiding citizen or is this guy a bad guy with a gun? So things have changed. And, I mean, I really have seen a big change in law enforcement. I mean, it really has. The video systems, I think, has been one of the best things to ever come about, and I have to laugh. The mayor and I were just talking last week. I was one of the first officers. I used to carry a tape recorder on my belt,
mm-hmm.
and I was one of the first policemen in this area to ever do that. And to me, I felt the tape recorder was twofold. One, when I turned it on, it obviously recorded what was said, but it made me make sure I was polite and made me guard what I was going to say. And then at the same time, it showed what kind of voice reaction or inflections that I got back from the other person. And the mayor was reiterating a case that we had back in the day where I asked a guy to get in the police car 27 times. And finally, on the 28th time, I put him in the police car. Mm-hmm. And you hear the slamming and the banging and, ouch, you broke my watch. And the guy came into court and said that he was polite and cooperative. And I just threw him in the car. And we played the tape. And I never forget his wife sitting in the back, just sinking down in the seat. And so, like I say, I really believe the video systems have really played a big role. And I have to say that, you know, I've had complaints filed on officers that the video, in almost every instance, other than one or two, proved that the officer was right and that the complaint really didn't have the merit that the person said it did, including one of them was with myself. And, you know, in a couple instances, the complaints were justified and those officers no longer work here. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a thing of, you know, it's a way of monitoring what your officers do. And I put a judge to it in that we don't have a lot of resisting arrest, which to me says that the officer is treating people in a way that they're not going to fight, but they understand what the officer is doing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if we have one resisting arrest for the whole year, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. So I feel that my officers are doing things professionally in the way that they should be. So, and that's one of the things I've stressed to them, you know, be professional. Don't lower yourself to that level. And I remember a letter that one guy wrote and complained who was in a position of authority, so to speak, in one of the neighboring towns, and I'm not going to say where, but he made all kinds of innuendos that my officer swore at him and was very unprofessional. And as it was, the officer that he complained about was a very religious officer, very soft-spoken officer. In fact, worked here probably 6 or 7 years, and never one time do I ever remember him saying a curse word. Mm-hmm. And so I was totally shocked when I saw that, or when I read the complaint that he wrote to the mayor, and I reviewed the videotape. And the videotape was, you know, like, oh my God, we're talking about two different stories. I mean, this guy immediately starts cussing and swearing at my officer. My officer says, sir, I really don't appreciate you swearing at me. I would ask maybe that you stop doing that. And, you know, there's no reason to be this upset over a simple traffic thing. And it was just, you know, the guy escalated up and down. My officer maintained a low keel. In fact, at one point said, sir, you're obviously having a bad day. He goes, why don't we just stop for a minute? You take a deep breath, count to five, and let's just start over. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it just showed that, you know, my officer was not there escalating things. He was trying to de-escalate it, not once, twice, but three or four times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the person who made the complaint was totally out of line. It was totally the instigator and agitator. And it was totally unprofessional to my guy. And my officer was a part-time officer, you know, maintained a level of professionalism that I had nothing to say but good. So I've seen a lot of things. Our town has, you know, not changed a lot in the years. We haven't grown much. We've had one expansion 34 years I've been here. And, you know, I guess as the years I've been here, I've seen kids that I saw in Safety Town that are now parents of children of now. And it's kind of funny to have a parent come up to say, you were my Safety Town police instructor. And I'm like, wow. Mm-hmm. So it's been interesting. Unfortunately, I've been here long enough that, and I just said this the other day, I've seen people that I've known a long time that have passed away. And mm-hmm. I've actually been there a couple times when a person died in my arms that I knew pretty well. And so I guess, you know, the longer you're here, the more you see. And like mm-hmm. I say, I still enjoy the job. I really do. It's very pleasurable at times. It's very frustrating at times because in a small town, everybody wants you to do your job, but not on them or their brother or their cousin or their sister. And, you know, and it's like I think sometimes people in a small town have a sense of entitlement that because they live here, they shouldn't be given a ticket. Mm-hmm. And I can remember one fellow complained about people speeding down one street. And we were sitting over there monitoring the speeds. And the first person we got speeding was the person who complained. And the officer wrote him a ticket, and the guy was just upset. I said, wait a minute. I said, you're the one that came here and complained. I said, you're 23 miles over the speed limit. I said, what did you want him to do in a residential side street? Mm-hmm. So it's just things like that. It's, you know, and the other part of it is I've seen a lot of officers come and go through my department. And, you know, some of them have actually, two of them have become chiefs of police. Some of them are in San Diego, California. One went to Key West. One's in Columbus. So I've seen a lot of officers who started here part-time that this was the stepping stone that have worked their way up to full-time jobs. I just had a young man leave here a couple weeks ago. He's going to work for a federal police department. Okay. So it's kind of a rewarding thing to see people start here. And some people don't forget where they came from. The fellow that's at San Diego gave me that plaque back there that he's a sergeant now, San Diego Police Department. So it's kind of interesting to see where they've come from. And it's interesting to see people as their career matures looking back on how they started. In fact, Chief Claymore Perkins started here as a part-time. And when he left, he went full-time at Perkins. He wrote me a letter about a month after he left and thanked me for all the guidance that I gave him. And it probably was one of the nicest letters that I'd ever gotten. That I was an old school teacher, so I guess one of my habits was red pen and circle stuff on reports. And I remember his letter said to me, he said, you know, Chief, I hated getting those notes with the red marks on them. And I, you know, at times I might have been upset about it. But now as I look back, I realize that you were making me a good officer. And I just want to thank you that when I came into a full-time job, my skills were above a lot of these people because of your guidance, and I realize now what you were doing. So that's a sense of, you know, it's like, that's rewarding, I think.
You know, I've heard teachers say that, and I used to teach as well, and that's the ultimate reward, really, is to have someone come back to you and say to you that there was something you did or you had shown them what to do, and that's the biggest thanks you can get. And I hear that because your daughter's a teacher, and you have that. And maybe she picked up on some of that too, and why she wanted to become a teacher. But I think that's important too, don't you, in jobs, that, you know, mentoring and teaching is such an important part of the job, of everyone's job when you're in positions.
Sure.
And, you know, sometimes we don't get a lot of that anymore. We see that in certain places we go in the service industry where there's not that guidance there.
The work ethic has changed from the old days. I mean, that's the big thing. The other thing, I think by nature, police officers tend to have big egos. I think it comes with the nature of the job. It's hard sometimes to get police officers to understand, and in other professions, I'm sure, that you're not trying to criticize them as much as you're giving them constructive criticism to make them a better officer so that what the mistake you made here doesn't pop up in a courtroom where a lawyer is there going to make you look like an idiot in front of jurors and whatever. And so that's what I've tried to instill in the officers. Look, you know, I'm trying to make you a better police officer. You know, you may be mad at me, you may not like me when it's done, but I'm going to show you the right way to do it. And, you know, what you do with that is up to you. And like I say, I think it's been very rewarding that I have seen a large number of my officers that get full-time jobs. I mean, just in this area, I mean, there's four or five that are at the Erie County Sheriff's Department. There's two or three at the Sandusky Police Department. There's two or three at Norwalk Police Department. Ones at Monroeville Police Department. So, like I say, I've seen them mature and go on. And, you know, and like I say, I've followed some of their careers from afar, so to speak, that they've excelled. And, like I say, two of them actually became chiefs of police. And others are in, you know, lieutenant, sergeant's positions in Bellevue that I'm thinking about. One's in Key West. So, like I say, another one's down in Florida. I'm thinking about that he went to Atlanta and then down to Florida. So it's been kind of rewarding to look back. And like you say, you may not get a direct thank you, but, you know, somewhere down the road, it's kind of an acknowledgement that, you know, this was my starting point and I learned a lot. And like I say, and in a small town, I mean, it's 90% boredom sometimes. It really is. It's a lot of repetition. And, you know, a lot of things is, you know, just being a deterrent by being visible. And that's the big part. And, you know, I tell people we have three state routes running through this town, and with the drag strip just south of town and 30,000-40,000 people there on a weekend, and Cedar Point 12 miles up the road, we have a lot of transit people coming through here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are all of them good people? I'd like to think most of them are, but unfortunately there's not. And like I say, over the years, I have taken a lot of guns off the street. I've had some knockdown, drag-out fights in this town in some of the bars when people get to drinking. And, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, I've kind of kept the town in an even keel, that people feel safe. And I think most people do feel safe in the village of Milan. And that's not just me. I have officers out here 24 hours a day, but I have them all on the same page, that we're kind of going in the same direction on the same boat. And that's what mm-hmm. I try to tell guys. And I think, you know, as a testament that people, I actually retired 10 years ago and they hired me back. So I've been here 10 years after retiring. And, you know, I've worked a lot of hours and gave my blood for this town, literally, and I have. Mm-hmm. But like I say, it's kind of a rewarding thing that, you know, when the day comes when I walk away, that I can look back and think I did the right thing for this town. And, you know, yes, I've made some enemies. That's by the nature of putting the badge on. You know, as I say, no one wants you to do your job on them. But when I put my head on the pillow at night, I guess I've said, you know what, I feel I was fair and I was firm, and mm-hmm. I did the best that I had to do with what I had to work with.
I imagine, too, what's hard in a small town is going to some of the accidents, too, that, you know, have ended in fatalities, especially for, you know, children and or people you know. Mm-hmm. And that's probably maybe one of the harder things you think of living in a small town, is because I know that there have been a few around here.
Oh, yeah. Former Chief Lindekamp, his daughter, I was the first one with an accident where she was a fatality. And yeah, it's hard. And like I say, the longer I'm here, as I said earlier, I mean, I've literally had people die in my arms that mm-hmm. I've known a long time. And so, you know, as you get older, it's, you know, you see a lot more of your friends come and go and pass and go. And I think right now the village is kind of going through a transition that we seem to have a lot more newer people, younger people moving into town as the elderly people are moving, or some of them have passed away. And I think with the economy, what it is, I've seen a few houses that have been foreclosed on, mm-hmm. unfortunately, that are now rental houses. And so we get a lot more transient people that move in from here or there. They live here 6 months and move on, and then there's another family. Mm-hmm. And unlike in the old days, I really felt like I knew probably 95% of this town and knew who someone was and where they live. It's gotten a lot tougher because we have more apartments. We have more people moving in and out. And I don't, unfortunately, know the people like I used to. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the downsides that I see in the current economy. We seem to have people coming and going. And, you know, it's sad. People have lost their houses due to loss of jobs. And, you know, Tenneco's are a big factor here, which has just moved to Mexico. That has impacted the town and it's impacting the village. I mean, the loss of income from that is making things very tight for this year. And this is, you know, things have been good for a long time, and 2010 is going to be a challenge because the dollars just aren't there to operate at the level that we have been in the past. So it's going to be interesting to see what shakes out of that.
You know, you moved to Milan, correct? You used to live in Norwalk?
I was born and raised in Norwalk. I married, my wife was from Milan, and in fact, the first place I lived was an apartment that I rented from Mayor Bickley. We mm-hmm. lived above his house, my wife and I did, so... Yep, that was back in 72, 74, something like that, yeah.
So most of your life has been then spent here in Milan?
Yes, yep. I've been a Milanite for, in fact, when Milan plays Norwalk, I stand in the end zone. I don't know which side to, I don't know which side to sit on. You know, part of me has the Norwalk in me, and now part of me has the Edison in me, so it's kind of a tough thing, but I've done that many times where I don't sit down, I'll stand for the game.
Oh, but that isn't a bad thing, though. It's nice. This says a lot about our communities and surrounding area, really, that, you know, there's still some of that small town element.
Well, it's like former Sheriff John Magnuson, who's the godfather of my daughter. We grew up right down the street from each other in Norwalk, and he became the sheriff, and I became the chief of police. In fact, my first experience in police cars was John was a officer with Perkins Township, and I went over there and rode with him in the police car. And it was like it got into my blood, and I really liked it. And I never forget the time when something bad would happen. John would kick me out of the police car. He'd go to the gas station, go, "You wait in there." And I'm like, "No, I want to go with you." And he goes, "No, I'm not explaining to your mother why you got hurt. You just wait right here. I'll be back." So, but I still laugh with him, and I still see John every now and then. He has multiple sclerosis and is bedridden. And I'll stop and see him. We tend to reiterate the old stories of ride with him. And he takes credit for getting me in the police bug. But I did. I knew that I wanted to. And I actually wanted to be a state highway patrolman. That's what I was kind of going for. And I graduated from high school in 69. I graduated from college in 73. And in 73, when I got out, the state highway patrol had a hiring freeze on. They weren't hiring. So I had a bachelor's degree in education, and I taught at Ehobee. I taught history and government for 6 years. And I remember when I told my mom I was going to quit teaching, she was so upset because I went to college to get my teaching degree. And I said, "Mom, I've always wanted to be a policeman. You know that." And she goes, "Yeah, I know." So in 76, I went part-time. Like I said, in 79, I went full-time. But looking back, I've enjoyed it. I mean, I really have. There have been some frustrating times. There have been some sad times. There's been some hard times there's things that in everybody's life you wish maybe you would have said differently or done something differently. But I had a few of those that I'm sorry to say that I wish I would have done things maybe a little different at times. But for the most part, I'm 98% happy with what I've done. And I think I've done things for the best interest of the village of Milan. And I feel pretty good that when judgment day comes, I think that I'll be looked at I feel I was one of the good guys.
Well, thank you, Chief. You know, looking at the photograph 20 years ago and the present photograph that I see, I'm glad to see that certain look, a sense of satisfaction on your face. Yeah. You can kind of see it from the photographs. And
just have less hair.
Yes. Well, you know, we all change. Isn't that funny? Yeah. A little bit. The glasses change. And I've laughed with some of the other participants in this whole project about, you know, some the looks have changed a little bit. But
sure.
I'm glad to see that you at least have your new space. And you know, we thank you, too, for participating in this interview, because it's a good perspective to give of your 20 years of service here and what you've meant to the community.
Well, thank you. I think this is a great project that you're undertaking. I think that a lot of people will appreciate it when it's all done.
Well, it's nice to know, because I've learned so much. So, again, I appreciate this, and thank you for the interview.
Thank you.